Our good friend Rich Mancuso put together a nice little boxing roundtable for us here tonight. Rich is to join us in a little bit here, as well as a true legend, writer, historian, Burt Randolph Sugar, and a gentleman who we had the pleasure of having on the show last year here. I think most would say probably the premier broadcaster and trainer in the world of boxing. When you think of those two professions, you think of this man, Teddy Atlas. It's a true pleasure to have back on the FDH Lounge. Teddy, welcome back, sir. How are you tonight?
Oh, good. How are you guys?
Oh, we're doing fine. Thanks. This actually, as we're talking right now, I guess 40 years ago tonight, folks would have been filing into the garden here. This is the anniversary of just a real epic. And again, I was too small to have really, known what was going on at the time. Just a wee little tiny lad. I know that you were much younger at the time as well. I don't know how much of a perspective you were able to have on it at the time, but certainly, I know you're a historian as well, and looking back on it here, it seems to me it was one of the big marvels, not just in boxing, but really in all of sports, this whole big fight atmosphere, big game, whatever you want to call it, depending on the sport. But Ali Frazier won the fight of the century. What an unbelievable thing 40 years ago tonight at the Garden.
It was pretty extraordinary. Unfortunately, part of my perspective is, I think it was in junior high school, and if it's either junior high school or my first year of high school, but I bet everything I had and didn't have on Ali. That's what I remember. I bet about $150, and I didn't have the money to pay the debt, so I was that confident that Ali was going to win. And then, of course, when Ali lost, I went out and did what you're supposed to do when you make a commitment, even when you're 14, 15 years old, and I found a way to get the money and pay my debts. And one of them was, it tells you something about the kind of teachers I had. One of them was to a teacher. So that's that's what I remember about that night. And I remember, even though I lost money and even though I was a kid of about 14 somewhere, I can't figure out the math right now, but I was a young kid, and I was disappointed that I had to make those payoffs, especially the one to my teacher. But it shows you how big Ali was to a kid, in this particular case, this kid, because that went away from my mind after a while. I was still disappointed that Ali didn't win. I could not conceive in my heart and in my mind that Ali could be beat. I believed in him that much, and no different than people that believed in Willie Mays and people that believed in Bill Russell that lived up in Boston and people that believed in Mickey Mantle. You know, that's how it was for me, who enjoyed boxing so much at a young age. I believed that much that Muhammad Ali could never lose.
Well, and it's really something. I know that there were a lot of other kids, I'm sure, out there that had the same sense in looking at that. He did seem so larger than life, and it really is kind of an odd thing. I had to look today on Google calendars just to even see. I was curious what day of the week that this was, and it was on a Monday. So we're so used these days to the bigger fights being on the weekends, whether it be, of course, Friday night fights on ESPN or ESPN2, as the case may be, or the Saturday night fights on pay-per-view or on HBO or Showtime. This was a Monday night, so, and of course it was before pay-per-view, so it was the whole closed circuit thing. So just kind of an odd thing. I guess they were kind of feeling their way around back in the day for when was the best time to have these things. Kind of a strange thing. It was before Monday Night Football was much of a habit. It had only come on the air the year before. So here, for a guy like you, Teddy, you get home from school on a Monday, and, there it is that night, and then you go into school the next morning and the fight's already happened.
Yeah, exactly. And you have to pay your debts off, like I said. That makes it even worse. You didn't do your homework. You're going to get in trouble for that. And you also have to find a way to come up with some cash. But again, the real thing to remember here and the real significance of the story is, as you just touched on, how bigger than life Ali was, that it was just like any other hero in any other sport, that they wouldn't let you down, that they couldn't lose, that they were magical. And now you look at it in hindsight, you look back and you say, after almost a four-year layoff, especially a talent that was athletic, a guy who depended on speed, he depended on timing, he depended on movement, he depended on all those kind of skill sets that are completely eroded and damaged by inactivity. And when you look at it that way, you say, well, how could I have thought that Ali could win? But again, it was the magic of Ali. You didn't think of those things. You just thought that, you know, just the persona of Ali, he would find a way. You know, he was a winner. It didn't matter that he was gone for almost 4 years. Again, when you look at it now, the kind of style he had, being away would damage him a lot more than it would have damaged a guy who had a physical go-ahead, you know, run-you-over style like Joe Frazier. That would not be damaged as much by inactivity as the kind of tools that Ali depended on.
You know, I can understand that, but to a certain extent also, I mean, as you look back on it, maybe you're being a little bit hard on yourself and thinking, well, how could I have thought that? Because maybe we're looking at it through the eyes of revisionism, Teddy, because what had Joe Frazier proven on that type of a level before he went through the meat grinder that was Ali? So it's kind of, Joe Frazier really kind of became the legend we know him as through that trilogy of fights.
Yeah, he is a fighter that some people could say gets too much credit. You know, look, he was a great heart. He was a great left hooker. He was a great, you know, workman. You know, always digging, always coming forward, never taking a round off. You know, an honest fighter. But you could also make the argument, which you just touched on, that he, in history, in the perspective of history, he's given too lofty of a place and too high of treatment because of his attachment to such a great fighter and a trilogy with those great fighter. Because outside of that, his body of work, you know, he got knocked out by George Foreman. You know, he beat Oscar Bonavina, but Bonavina had him on the floor in both those fights. A guy that Ali, after 3.5 years off, comes back and he knocks Bonavina out in the 15th round. So he also knocked out a smaller Jimmy Ellis, who looked more like a middleweight. You know, and again, you could say that he's given a little bit more credit than he would deserve if he didn't attach himself to such an icon. And there's probably a lot of truth to that.
Well, it's very interesting, and we'll be getting another perspective here as well. Two down, one to go. Our good buddy Rich Mancuso, who set this up in the first place, we're still endeavoring to get him on the phone lines, but we will now have on the phone lines here together two boxing legends in the FDH Lounge. To Teddy Atlas, we add legendary writer, historian, Burt Sugar. Burt Randolph Sugar. Burt, it's a pleasure to have you on the FDH Lounge, sir, tonight. How are you?
Fine, I think, and hi, Teddy, if I've got him.
Hi, Burt.
You, both of you look like a telephone from here.
That's better than people generally say I look, Bert. But it's great to have you on. 40 years to the night of the fight of the century here. This is, I guess, sort of the equivalent of that in the FDH Lounge, having the two of you on together. We got warmed up here talking to Teddy about this. Let's get your thoughts. You probably have more firsthand thoughts of it, certainly in terms of covering it professionally, than either of us do, given that it was in 1971 here. So thoughts on this epic event that really did so much to kind of shape the modern landscape of big time fights and maybe even other sports as well.
Well, first of all, the good news is I was there at the arena at Madison Square Garden that night. Mm-hmm. The bad news is it was 40 years ago and I'm still here.
That's good news, Bert.
but it was not just a fight. It was an event. It transcended just being a fight. It was a morality play in the middle of the Vietnamese conflict. And one man, Ali, stood for the anti-Vietnamese war. The other man, unbeknownst to him, had become the standard bearer, Joe Frazier, for the pro, hard hat approach to the war for it. So that took it to another realm, not just a fight. Albeit the fight matched the buildup, it paid off. But it was an event I don't think that will ever be able to be duplicated again in the history of sports, let alone boxing.
Bert, I just like to expand on that for a second. Again, as somebody who was there and as somebody who saw it unfold from the media perspective, it's interesting because, again, everything I've learned about it has been, of course, subsequent to that point in time. But my sense as sort of an amateur sports historian has been exactly what you said, that it really kind of set the template for what was to come. That in this day and age, I mean, there's the Super Bowl every year. There's, if you want to go further afield, WrestleMania, all these other things here. But the fight of the century did a lot to shape this, didn't it?
Yeah, it did in part, but it stood on its own more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just the fight. There'd been previous fights of the century, mm-hmm. going back to Johnson and Jeffries in 1910. Mm-hmm. In fact, the best name, Barney Nagler, a writer, called it the fight. He needed no other really rosy terms. It was just the fight. This was big enough. And because we lived in a world that wasn't fractionated like it is now with tweeters and my faces and other things, everybody was concentrated on this one fight as an event. It just is something you can't duplicate today. Magazines were in the boss position. Every cover, front cover, had this fight on it. Life magazine, Sports Illustrated, Look. Every one of them did. Television, three major networks, every one of them did. So you couldn't get away from it. This was, and today you can get away from anything. Just hide your head in the computer and you're away. In fact, I'm happy you have Teddy on, because Teddy and I have just written a new book called The Ultimate Book of Boxing Lists, in which we think one of the most significant fights of all time was this fight we're talking about in one of our lists.
Well, great anticipation, and I definitely wanted to plug the book here tonight. Let's compare and contrast for a second. I'm sure this is only going to make the fight seem even bigger. Teddy, we were talking about this when you were on with us in the fall here, about the proliferation of Russian fighters and how so much of the sport, at least at the heavyweight level, has moved overseas to the old world here. What does it tell us that 40 years after the fight of the century, we're expected to now get excited for Vladimir Klitschko, David Haye, the big unification match, quote unquote, to unify three of the four alphabet soup titles here? I mean, I guess the answer is kind of self-evident, Teddy, but give me your thoughts on that as far as, then and now, what these two fights exemplify.
Well, I mean, back then you identified much more closely as with the fighters. You knew what they were. You knew what their struggles were, what their fight was, you know, every day in life, outside the ring, what they stood for. Bert said it very well. One guy stood for this, one guy stood for that. You were invested in that. There was one champion, for the most part, in every division. There was one heavyweight champion of the world. There wasn't three or four or three and a half or five. There was one. And you knew everything that you could know and that you wanted to know about those guys. And again, you knew what they were inside, what they stood for, the kind of people they were, how they thought, and what they were on the outside, and what they were when they stepped in the ring. Nowadays, all you know, for the most part, is that it's called a heavyweight championship fight. It's called a heavyweight title. It's an event. It's an event where they're fighting for the heavyweight title, much like the Super Bowl. I mean, it's not as extreme. It doesn't get the extravagant lead up the way the Super Bowl does, but there's a title to it. It stands for, you know, what used to be. It used to mean something. It used to be the heavyweight title, and these guys happen to be filling in and there that night. But it's hollow after that. It's for a title, but after that, you don't really know who they are. You're not really invested in them, and you're not necessarily interested in the outcome. You're just interested in knowing that somebody has a heavyweight title, and there still is a heavyweight title. And the drop-off of boxing overall can, in some ways, can be attached to the drop-off in the interest and the significance of the heavyweight champions.
No, that's very well said. You know, and I again, just personally, I don't think that's a very healthy development. I'm kind of an elitist when I look at this. I like my champions, all things being equal, to be kind of epic. So it's disappointing to me when it's not the case. Bert, let me ask you your thoughts on that as well. And I'll mention that when we had Teddy on in the fall, we talked about briefly with him the fact that the last real transcendent heavyweight title fight I think that we had was probably Lewis and Tyson back in June of 2002. This has got to be, if not the longest drought in the modern history of sports, one of the longest ones. I mean, there can't be but one or two droughts longer than this of not having an epic heavyweight title fight like this. Bert, I mean, we've come a long way from the fight of the century and not in a good direction, it seems.
Well, what happens, Rick, is, first of all, Americans love big things. We love big bank accounts. We love big cars. We love big-chested women. We love big fighters. And when they're not American, it loses something to us. It's happened before. Sometimes when the heavyweight champion is not exciting or is not fighting fighters who are not even household names in their own households, like Larry Holmes, an underappreciated champion, but he's fighting Osvaldo Ocasio and Leroy Jones, we look to the middle area weight classes and we find satisfaction in a Leonard and a Hearns fight or a Hagler and a Hearns fight. But we don't even have that anymore because Mayweather and Pacquiao seems never to be made. But the heavyweight division has been ours. And I remember Ring Magazine in the old days, they had a ring record book. And it used to have a little box that said, heavyweight champions who weren't American. You know, and it go Tommy Burns, Canada, Primo Canary, Italy, etc. Ingemar Johansson, Sweden. Well, now you can put a box in, say, that says heavyweight champions that are American. And we've lost interest in the heavyweight or big men events. And maybe that's why when two undefeated, as they were, Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali, climbed in the ring as the first men to break the $1 million pay barrier, both getting $2.5 million that night in 1971. It was a singular event, and Teddy used the word correctly, that really transfixed our attention. Hardcore boxing fans and peripheral boxing fans, casual ones alike, because it meant so much to so many different people on so many different levels. And it was not only a sellout at Madison Square Garden, and the mobs that were around it. I mean, you had to see what an event can do. They had to close off bridges because there were so many cars coming into New York. They couldn't clear the streets around the garden. Ali and Frazier were not allowed after the weigh-in that afternoon to go back to their hotels. They had to stay in the arena. Frazier went to sleep. Ali counted all the seats in the house. The cars, the limousines lined up from 33rd Street where Madison Square Garden is, all the way up to 110th Street to disgorge their elite passengers. Frank Sinatra is taking pictures for Life magazine. Burt Lancaster is doing the closed circuitry. Diana Ross, all of them are in the audience, all the big stars. And you look up at the third balcony, and there's the former Vice President of the United States, Hubert Humphrey. Obviously, he didn't get a better ticket. This was a place to be. And you really can't say that about a lot of events, no matter what they are, sports or otherwise.
Well, just really transcendent and, again, just emblematic of a different time and a different place in society and in sport and on many different levels. And as far as different levels of boxing and different ways to look at it, again, let's go back to this book that you two gentlemen have teamed up on. Truly unbelievable thing here. I've definitely got to get my hands on this. I noticed, among other things here, I did see in a press release that Raging Bull was named the number one best boxing movie of all time. I think the Raging Bull folks put that out as a press release because it was their 30th anniversary edition coming out on DVD. Teddy, talk about this, about some of the things that really stood out to you in the formation of this book, whether it be movies, whether it be fights. Again, it has to be personal for you two guys loving boxing and being so intertwined with it as you are. But what were some of the most special things for you going through, Teddy, and looking at and re-immersing yourself in the course of putting these lists together?
Well, just doing it together with Bert was an experience, you know, and being able to hear things from his perspective, from different eras, and, you know, guys that he saw and guys that he covered, and then the guys that I saw. And I was fortunate. I was also very lucky where I lived up in Catskill for 7 years with Custom Auto while I was training fighters. And Jim Jacobs and Bill Caden had the biggest fight film collection in the world at that time, Big Fights Incorporated. And in those days, it wasn't like today with DVDs and digital stuff. Everything was on 18-millimeter film. So we had the projector upstairs, and it stayed in my bedroom. And we would get sent the films of, you know, all the great fighters from the golden years of boxing, whether it was from the 20s, from the 30s. I mean, some film that nobody else got a chance to see. And we were lucky enough to see even the great Harry Greb, which there was very little footage available on the legendary fighter who had over 300 fights, the Pittsburgh Windmill. And he fought in so many different weight classes, from welterweight to heavyweight. And to get to see these guys and to now go back in your memory and remember sitting up there in the room at Custom Models after I finished training fighters during the day, and then look at, you know, the 18-millimeter tape, look on the projector, and watching Henry Armstrong, you know, all these different guys fight, Ike Williams, I mean, Joe Louis, just all of them, Ezra Charles, Jersey Joe Walcott, all these guys, and then have to research your mind and just the images of seeing those guys so you could answer the questions when Bert was saying, okay, now, Teddy, who do you think had the best left hook? Who do you think had the best jab? Who do you think had the best footwork? Who do you think was the most elusive guy? Who do you think was the best inside fighter? You know, who do you think had the most heart? Who do you think was a guy that was the best guy at counterpunching? Who was the, and just to go through the way that I did it was to just remember watching those films of the guys that I didn't get to see live. It was a visit back down, you know, memory lane. It brought you back to those days up in a room when your only responsibility was to make a fighter a little bit better, to go in the gym during the day and make the pros better, go to gym at night, make the amateurs a little bit better, and then go sit there at night and look at the old-time guys and see what you could pick up, see what you could learn, see what you could pass on to one of the fighters in the gym. So it was a great experience, and it was nice, like I said, it was nice partnershiping up with Bert and being able to look at it through two sets of eyes.
Oh, Teddy, that's incredible to get to. I can't even imagine to get to see things that so few other people on Earth had gotten a chance to see with those rare films. And we've always heard over the years about how much Mike Tyson enjoyed watching those during his formative years. It stands to reason, yeah, that it would have come from Custom Auto and the guys in the camp there. So that must have been so cool for you to get to see those things. I'm curious on the other side of the equation here, Bert, as somebody who you know, lived through a lot of the history, at least in the last couple of decades here. Again, how much for you, Bert, was it a case of reflecting on things you'd seen versus having to go back in and watch some films and everything like that yourself? What was your methodology like as you were compiling lists?
Well, Teddy sells himself short. He brought a tremendous insight, particularly when he would recite some things that Custom Auto had told him. Not, you know, verbally, not visually, about a fighter named Sid Terrace who could throw three jabs while his feet were off the canvas. Remember that, Teddy?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but Teddy could bring a new look at things, and I delighted in it. I remember once I had a list, and I asked Teddy to look at it. Fighters who were awkward, and I had Gene Fulmer on there, and Teddy said, he's not an awkward fighter, he's one of those takes two to give one. I said, aha, a new list. So he was extremely important. And I knew I needed someone to play off of. And he was better than playing off of. He was playing off me at times in a book of this sort, the Ultimate Book of Boxing Lists, so that you could get a feel. And I'm not sure, some of those lists we still don't disagree on, but that's the beauty of the Ultimate Book of Boxing Lists. It's an argument starter, not settler.
Exactly. Yeah, the notion of you two guys doing this together, Bert, point very well taken, because, again, you know, if you were going to be partnered up with anybody on earth, I mean, I think most people would probably tell you that's the dream team, you two guys doing this together. And I knew that even before we had Teddy on the show last fall, just from, you know, years and years and years of watching him on TV and enjoying his commentary. And this, I can't wait to get my hands on this book and check it out. It really must be something special. And
Rich Mancuso's book, obviously he can't read it.
Yeah, speaking of Mancuso, where is he? He's the guy that set this up. And
he's lost again.
Probably.
You'll borrow his or we'll send you one. But I have to tell you, and Teddy can listen or put his fingers in his ears, it was a pleasure to work with him because Teddy knows his sport.
Yep.
And he gives it a different look than I do. I used the proper word, perspective. And it really was fun to do. Hard work, but fun. And I enjoyed it. I enjoy him. And I think we have a product. Yes, we still argue, but so should everyone who reads it, because we teach them history, but we also ask them to give their thoughts. It's one of those, you do it as well as we do it. And you know what? A reader is as right as we are. They have their own opinions. This is one of those subjective books where everybody's right.
Teddy, what about that? The different perspectives. I think that's what makes it really seem like a dream team to those of us from the outside kind of looking at it in. You've got Bert, you know, kind of from the straight scribe perspective. You know, you've been in the game as a trainer, now verging into the broadcasting a lot over the years. It seems like between the two of you, you've really looked at it from just about every different type of angle imaginable.
Yeah, and I think that's important because, you know, when you look, if you're judging a baseball player, they talk about the five skills, you know, the versatility of the player. You don't want a guy who can just hit it out of the park. You want a guy who can hit for average. You know, you want a guy who can run the bases. You want a guy who can field, a guy who can throw. And when you're looking at a fighter, you want to see it from all those perspectives. You want to be able to see it from all those viewpoints. You know, you don't want to just see the guy that can hit the home run. You know, Ernie Shavers could hit a home run. He could knock walls over. But he didn't have the ability to win a heavyweight title. Why? And I think we examine that. There's intangibles. There's magic. There's other things. There's intricacies that are involved in a great baseball player, a great basketball player, a great football player, a great boxer. Why does he become champion? Why is he allowed to get that word attached to his name, in front of his name, champion? How does he get that? Because he has the ability to do these special things. And so we're able to look at it, I think, from an overhead view, where I'm looking at it from that angle, Bert's looking at it from his angle, and the best thing is that the audience, the readers, get to see it from all angles. They get to see those things that were missing in Ernie Shavers. Yeah, you know, he could punch as good as anyone with a right hand, but why, if he was one of the great punchers of all time, why was he missing something to become world champion? And I think that's part of what makes it an interesting read for a lot of different people.
Oh, yeah. This really, this is tremendous because, again, you know, as a writer myself and somebody who is, you know, fascinated by different perspectives here, you know, the thought of you guys looking at this from as many different angles as you do just makes me kind of lick my chops. This thing's really...
I mean, the greatest knockouts.
Uh-huh.
You know, a lot of people might have thought, well, it was this, it was that. You know, it was seen maybe in a more contemporary setting where you saw Big John Tate get just knocked the heck by Mike Weaver. That was a hell of a left hook in the 15th round. There's no more 15 rounds, so you're not going to see that. But he fell face first. But then you got a guy like Jersey Joe Walcott who fights the Cincinnati Cobra, a great fighter like Ezra Charles, a great fighter. And he doesn't just throw the punch the way that Weaver threw it that night. It was a great punch, but he threw a cold punch and he landed on a cold guy, a guy standing right there. But if you're going to hit the Cincinnati Cobra, if you're going to hit Ezra Charles, well, now we got to explain to the audience, how do you hit this guy? You don't just throw a cold left hook or a cold left uppercut. You got to set him up. You got to hypnotize him. You got to mesmerize him. And that's what Ezra Charles, that's exactly what Jersey Joe did to Ezra Charles. He walked to him. He adjusted his shorts. That's another thing. A lot of people saw guys adjust their shorts. They thought that the shorts were too big. No, they were doing it to take the eyes of their opponent off of him, to set something up. Nothing was wasted. So he adjusts his shorts a little bit. There's about 10 feet separating them, and he starts walking to Ezra Charles. And as he's walking to him in rhythm, his shoulders are going back and forth like a clock going from one side to the other, one of those old-fashioned clocks, back and forth, back and forth. So he's shifting his shoulders from left to right, from right to left. And then as he gets close, bang, with one motion, he comes up with a left uppercut and knocks the great Ezra Charles dead. And again, it wasn't just the power of the punch. It wasn't a cold punch. It was set up 10 feet before by him moving his shoulders, which looked like showboating. It looked like wasted motion, but it was beautiful. It was planned. It was
genius.
And
Ezra Charles said after that fight, he was knocked out by a sucker punch.
and he made him a sucker by setting him up. And it was and just showing the audience that these great athletes, these great fighters, what their true genius was. It wasn't just their brawn. It wasn't just their physicality. It wasn't just their power. There was much more to what made them geniuses. And we try to explore that, and we try to show that.
Well, and let it be known, Teddy entered that after I showed him my list. He said, you got to have that uh-huh. punch in there. And there's one other thing in this book,
uh-huh.
and it doesn't deal with Bert or Teddy or Teddy or Bert. And it's that we have celebrity lists in there. Muhammad Ali picking the greatest heavyweight champions and not putting his own name in there. Ray Leonard, hardest fights he ever fought. These are questions you always wanted to ask these fighters. Ernie Shavers, and Teddy had mentioned him, hardest punches he ever threw. So you're getting a perspective, Teddy's word, from the fighters themselves. What's interesting in Sugar Ray Leonard's list of toughest fights he ever had, I think it's number 7, he puts Dick Eklund in. And if you don't remember that name, you haven't seen the movie The Fighter.
No, well, this is really outstanding stuff, really covering the sweet science from all angles. Gentlemen, I wish we had more time to be able to do this. We have the great pitching coach, Rick Peterson, coming up on deck here. We are obliged to give him a call. I tell you what, this was absolutely tremendous talking to you guys. Teddy, you know that we love you. We've had you on before. We're so glad to have had you back on. And, Bert, the same goes for you, too. I would truly love to have you back on as well.
Thank you, and Teddy, I'll see you Sunday.
Yeah, right. See you Sunday, Bert, and thank you guys. It was a pleasure talking with you.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Two ultimate legends of the game, ladies and gentlemen, Teddy Atlas and Bert Sugar. Nothing more needs to be said.